If you drive around and think there's no more space to build cheap housing, a new project from the University of Miami will show you that's not the case. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. That project is called Land Access for Neighborhood Development, or LAND. It's the creation of UM's Office of Civic and Community Engagement. They found there's a lot of potential land for affordable housing projects all throughout the county. We'll learn more about where that land is and how lawmakers and developers can use the tool to create much-needed housing for working families. Also, Governor Ron DeSantis promised he would make the environment, specifically issues around Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades, one of his top priorities. He's made some major moves recently, like hiring a new chief science officer. WLRN's new environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, will tell us all about him. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN during the spring membership campaign. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. And as always, thank you so much for your support. Well, we know how expensive it is to live in South Florida. A report from the Miami Urban Future Initiative found that homeowners and renters here are among the most cost-burdened in the country. And by the way, if you want to hear our conversation with researcher Richard Florida about that report, you can find it on our website, wlrn.org/sundial. Now, part of the issue developers raise is a lack of available land for affordable housing development. But a new tool from the University of Miami shows that's not the case. The LAND tool, or Land Access for Neighborhood Development, identifies parcels of land throughout Miami-Dade County that are being underutilized or even vacant. Now, this land could be used for new affordable housing projects, perhaps. Joining us now to discuss it is George Damien de la Paz and Robin Backen with the University of Miami's Office of Civic and Community Engagement. George, Robin, thank you so much for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know what, Robin, let me start with you. We say it all the time as we're driving around, there's no more room to build and all these cranes are up and we're building up now, but turns out there's a lot of land still available.
Right. So in the process of creating this tool, we discovered that there's actually 500 million square feet of vacant or underutilized land throughout Miami-Dade County that's owned either by the county or one of the 34 municipalities or a civic institution such as a faith-based organization, an anchor institution like a hospital or a university. So it's really an astounding number.
Now, before this project took a few years to put together, but before that, I mean, did you have an idea of like, oh, there's probably no land? And then you were surprised when you saw all that's available.
We were absolutely surprised. It's the equivalent of the land mass of Manhattan. So this is quite a bit of land. Now, granted, much of this land is scattered throughout the county. But what we also found is that there are sites that are contiguous to one another. So you might have city-owned property adjacent to county-owned property, adjacent to faith-based organization property. And when you think about being able to aggregate all that land into one lot, it really creates new possibilities for what could happen with land in developing affordable housing.
And as I mentioned, this has been a few years in the works, but how did it all start? What was the catalyst?
So when we first founded the Office of Civic and Community Engagement at UM in 2011, we really wanted to devote our resources and energy to addressing the affordable housing crisis. As you mentioned, Miami is one of the least affordable metropolitan regions in the country. So we know, for example, that when you combine the cost of housing with the cost of transit, the metropolitan Miami area is the least affordable in the country, especially for our low-income renters. So we created what started out as one mapping platform called MAP, the Miami Affordability Project, that maps cost burden and access to affordable and public housing, and then developed a whole suite of online mapping tools so that people could really visualize the landscape of housing affordability across South Florida and have a better understanding of land use and access in the county.
George, real quickly, I mean, we look at this map and, you know, as Robin said, we've got it scattered about, but there is a lot available. But real quickly, is just describe how you gathered the data and information to put this map together.
Sure. So we pulled data from various sources, including the Transportation Planning Organization, the Property Appraiser, and the City of Miami's Housing Agency. And by gathering all this scattered information into one interactive map for the very first time, we're solving a real pain point for community development organization.
How should I, when I'm looking at that map, how should I be looking at it? What you know, what really the best way to understand, because again, I'm looking at all these different plot points scattered about the county, but really the best, easiest way to see it.
So it's important to remember, of the 500 million square feet, some of those properties could be unbuildable or suboptimal because of encumbrances, its position, zoning, or environmental contamination. So this is a data set that's going to have to be continuously refined over time. Now, I think one of the most important insights of land is where there are county-owned surplus lots. So these are properties that are no longer needed by any of the county's agencies, and that could be conveyed, sold, or leased to an eligible for-profit or nonprofit developer. With land, you could identify where there's concentrations of these surplus properties for the first time. And I think there's a lot of potential for aggregations or land swaps using these vacant surplus properties.
Who is this for? Who this particular site and this information, who is it best for?
So one of our goals in creating this tool is to basically level the playing field and democratize data. So big developers have had access to this data for a long time. They can pay land use attorneys. There are a number of online sites that charge a licensing fee that are for profit. So certainly people who have access to those have been able to see where there's land. But what we wanted to do is basically put this data in the hands of everyday residents, community organizations, housing activist groups, so they could be more effective strategists and advocates for affordable housing.
Robin, when you look at this map, just a glance at it, you know, what's the thing that jumps out most to you?
One of the things that jumps out is that there are really sites all over the county. Now, as George said, some of those sites they're scattered. Some of them are non-conforming, but it does create opportunities to think innovatively about how we can use that land. So, for example, there's a project happening right now in South Miami where they are piloting a container home to fit on a very small lot. But again, we're seeing all over the country this movement towards micro units, towards not having to have parking, because we want to move towards a more transit-friendly mode of urban development. So it presents lots of innovative opportunities, both for aggregating large parcels of land, but also for taking small, non-conforming lots and creating new models for development.
George, just real briefly, is the fact that, again, you have empty lots, but you also have lots that are owned, but this is information that perhaps policymakers or developers can look at if they want to bargain for something.
That's right. Absolutely right. This platform will help community-based organizations to identify potential development opportunities near transit.
Again, I'm talking with George Damien de la Place and Robin Backen with the University of Miami Center for Civic Engagement. We're discussing the new land tool, which identifies parcels of empty or underutilized land that could be used for affordable housing development, possibly. Now, we're going to take a break here and continue this conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, thank you so much for your support. Well, let's continue our conversation with George Damien de la Paz and Robin Backen. They are with the University of Miami's Office of Civic and Community Engagement, and they are behind a new tool for identifying available land across the region for affordable housing development. It's called LAND, the LAND tool, and you can find links and resources on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Robin, but George, please jump in on this, is, you know, one of the obstacles for affordable housing development is zoning. Does the tool account for where affordable housing development is permitted?
So right now, we don't have explicit zoning information on the tool, but we do have information about everything related to that particular parcel. So you have the size of the parcel, the owner of the parcel, the folio number, so you can find out what the zoning is for that parcel. There are also examples of changing zoning in order to be able to create more opportunities for affordable housing. But in the future, when we do updates to the tool, zoning is one of the features that we will include, as well as overlaying opportunity zones, so that policymakers understand how to maximize opportunities for tax financing through building affordable housing.
George, the city of Miami right now is working with FIU to develop a comprehensive roadmap for affordable housing development. But how can the land tool assist in anything like that? How can the land tool assist policymakers right now?
Sure. So Miami Homes for All, which is leading that effort, is actually already using the tool to identify potential sites for affordable housing. Policymakers could use the platform to find out where there are municipal-owned properties adjacent to county-owned vacant properties, and how those properties could potentially be aggregated to a larger parcel, or there could be some opportunities for swaps. So there's a number of different use cases.
Have we seen any other city right now that's using it? Is there anything like this anywhere? Because I'm wondering if any other city or county has a tool that's similar to this so that they have access to that information as well. Or is this that unique?
It's really unique.
You haven't seen anything like it anywhere?
No.
I mean, is this something, Robin, that you envision seeing kind of spreading out beyond Miami-Dade County, though, beyond South Florida?
Well, when we first started our MAP, or Miami Affordability Project, that was focused on Miami-Dade County, and we then expanded it to Broward and Palm Beach. We have had conversations with Mel Martinez, for example, who wanted to see it expand to other cities across the state of Florida. George and I have presented these tools nationally and even internationally, and there's been a tremendous amount of interest. But again, much of the model is aggregating large amounts of data and mapping it and making it easily accessible, but it also requires a really firm understanding of the local community and local market. So when we were developing this tool, we were repeatedly meeting with policymakers from the county's Department of Public Housing, for example, as well as nonprofit advocacy groups to see what kinds of features would be useful and valuable to them, to see how we could make it more user-friendly. So I think there's a real value to being really rooted and grounded in your local market.
So right now, when you look at it, Robin, what could be better? And where do you see how you're going to improve it?
So as I mentioned, we want to include zoning. We also want to include opportunity zones. One of the things we did include is county and city commission boundaries, so that commissioners, as well as their constituents, could identify where there is land in their particular districts.
You know what? In looking at the map, are there a couple areas that you think, wait a minute, look at all this opportunity? I mean, granted, as you said, there is a lot throughout the county. But when you look at it, can you point to people and say, look at all this right here? What are some of those neighborhoods?
Yeah, so what's really striking is a lot of the land is concentrated in some of our poorest neighborhoods in the city of Miami. So in Liberty City, in Brownsville. And one of the features of the lands tool is there's a calculator. So you see an icon for a calculator and you click on that and then click on all of the vacant or underutilized parcels, and that will aggregate the square footage of that land. So you can really see, if you've got adjacent properties, how much lands can you actually put together and convey for use of affordable housing, particularly in our low-income communities where it's so needed.
What have lawmakers said after this came out? Who have you spoken to, and what kind of things are they telling you about, you know, their first impressions?
Sure. So George has been doing, as I mentioned, a variety of demonstrations for policymakers all throughout the creation of the tool. So we work very closely with the county's Department of Public Housing and their staff, and also with the city of Miami, so with their planning and zoning department, and with the mayor's office. So when we launched the tool a couple weeks ago, Mayor Suarez was present and really was overwhelmed by the power of the tool, because really what we're trying to do is just present vast swaths of data in a usable format, in a mapping tool that's interactive, that's easy for anyone to use and visualize and identify property.
George, you know, you think about, I mean, the data, it could be overwhelming for people. So how do you convince people, look, data, how this is how you're going to marry it to all of this, you know, these true real stories of people and their struggles and every day, this is how data can help. How do you do that? How do you make it easy for us to understand?
So we're very intentional about making this tool as lean and user-friendly as possible. For the data challenge, you could actually click on the help button, and it breaks down how to use the tool in 5 easy steps.
All right, again, talking about this new program that has been created by the University of Miami Center for Civic Engagement. It's called LAND, and it basically shows that there is a lot of underutilized or even open land that's available in Miami-Dade County for possibly affordable housing projects. I've been talking with George Damien de la Paz and Robin Backen, again, from the Civic Engagement Center. Robin, George, thank you so much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
It is a fascinating project. And by the way, you can learn more on our social media. Just find us at WLRN Sundial. The map is actually easy to look at, and it might surprise you. It's just how much is available. All right, well, coming up, a conversation with our new environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, about the blue-green algae crisis in the state and how it may be causing a lot of issues for marine animals like dolphins. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support. Governor Ron DeSantis promised during the campaign to make restoring the Everglades and water quality a key part of his administration. And to date, his moves have pleased not only the staunchest of Republicans, but many Democrats. He recently appointed Dr. Thomas Frazier as the new chief science officer for the state.
Our water-dominated environment is inextricably linked to the health and happiness of all Floridians and the state's economic well-being. In fact, the legacy of our leadership will rest squarely on an ability to ensure the water resources in this state are restored, protected, and conserved to meet the needs of current and future generations.
And that is Dr. Frazier when he was announced earlier this week. We're joined now by our new environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, formerly of the Miami Herald. Jenny, you know the seat. You've been in it before many times, so you're just used to it. Now it's just regular. Great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Monday, the governor appoints Dr. Frazier as the state's first chief science officer. What do we know about Dr. Frazier?
So Dr. Frazier had been head and still is head of the University of Florida's Department of Natural Resources. He's been at the university for quite a few years. He has a background in studying freshwater and marine systems and environmental pollution, nutrient pollution, the phosphorus and the nitrogen that we hear so much about that is part of the, you know, causes of the blue-green algae red tide.
What's been the response to this choice?
I think people are optimistic. You know, I think we had a previous administration. Rick Scott famously refused to meet with scientists at one point. And naming a chief science officer who is going to help organize a blue-green algae task force is really a step forward and a move toward, you know, tackling what has become a really awful problem in the state.
It's really interesting because, as you said, Governor Scott didn't want to talk to scientists, didn't want to talk about a lot of science stuff. And then Governor DeSantis has come in. He's made it a big part. He made it a big part of his campaign, and he's made a lot of different moves. And he's talking about climate change even. What do you make about this? And the fact that the governor has... He's kind of going in this direction.
Right. I mean, I think when you're confronted with what we were confronted with last year.
The blue-green algae.
Yeah, it's like you can't not do anything. I mean, that was became a big issue in the election. You know, people were outraged. You know, they were demanding something be done and action be taken more quickly. And I think the climate change, that's an interesting issue. I just saw a quote from Dr. Frazier. You know, he believes that climate change is something that humans have caused, and that's the big pivot.
And we heard yesterday, obviously, from the Miami Herald Influencer Series, when they polled people this year, water quality and climate issues are near the top of the list now compared to before. Moving over to, there was a story that you did write when you were with the Herald about this new study from the University of Miami. This one, a bit scary, and this talking about the blue-green algae blooms and its impact on dolphins.
Right.
And that there was a study that found that there were dolphins that they found that had Alzheimer-like brain diseases. Linked to that?
So yes, they found these neurological issues in dolphin that also had traces of an element in blue-green algae. So while the study was too narrow and small, it was just, I think, 14 dolphins overall, and they were dolphins taken from Florida in a 2005 die-off and some from California. So they couldn't link there was no cause and effect. They're not there yet, but they are now embarking on a second study based on dolphins that died in this past year's red tide. There were about 150 dolphins that died, and they're going to take another look. They're going to go back in. They're going to look at more issue, broader areas of the brain, and see if they can't make more conclusive connections.
And were they already doing similar research on sharks?
Yes. So they found the same kind of algae levels in sharks, but sharks' brains aren't as complicated. And what they like about the dolphin study is that it's a more complex brain that's, you know, not quite the human brain, but it's complex like the human brain. And that the way the scientist was explaining it to me is these were dolphins that are, these toxins are turning up them in the natural environment. So it's not like you're feeding them doses to see what happens. This is how it occurs naturally. So they serve as sentinels for what could possibly, the potential harm to humans.
And I mean, because as you said, because the dolphin brain is a bit more complex, is there any, do they even think about or talk about, well, if it could affect the dolphin this way, what would it do to humans?
I don't know if they're there yet, but they did find that they went to the part of the dolphin brain where they thought it would be most obvious, which is their navigational system, because that's the complex, and they thought if there's anything wrong in a dolphin, you'll find it there. And sure enough, that's where they found traces of the toxin and then the neurological issues.
I'm talking with WLRN's new environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovic, coming from the Miami Herald, where she spent 5 years reporting on environmental issues there. She's just started with us this week. Let's move over to, this is another big one for the governor. This has to do with the South Florida Water Management District. Back in January, Governor DeSantis called for the resignation of all 9 members. First, though, let's remind people what that board does. What this governing board, what do they do? What's their power?
So they oversee the South Florida Water Management District, which is 16 counties, and it is the state's largest water management district. They're the ones that sort of pull the levers on the canals and the pumps and take care of flood control. But a more important issue probably is they are they oversee Everglades restoration for the state. I shouldn't say more important, but equally important. And, you know, this is this ongoing project. It's created in 2000. We are more than, you know, halfway through what was supposed to be a 30-year project. We've yet to complete a single project. There's intense pressure on them to get something done. And so this board is sort of there. They oversee that. And again, it's the largest water management district in the state.
So he has appointed 8 people so far, 2 of them from Miami-Dade County. One person that he wants on the board that he's appointed is Ron Bergeron. But he's still going through a process right now. There's an ethics commission looking into him. But remind us of who he is, because this is a man who's been around a long time. He's got a lot of history here.
Right. He has been born and raised in Davie, Florida. He is a very colorful character. He drives a Hummer. maybe a couple, but I know one I've seen has like alligators on the side of it. He is a hunter. He has a fishing camp out in the water conservation areas. He drives an airboat. He was a self-made man. You know, he started his own business clearing land, eventually built it into the state's largest road construction and land development company. In 2007, Charlie Crist appointed him to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. He has, you know, come under criticism by environmentalists for some of his projects in wetlands and in the Glades. I think his appointment to the Water Management Board was not without controversy.
And so because right now what they're looking into is, are there potential conflicts of interest with him?
Right. So this the issue that caused this review was shortly after he was appointed, or DeSantis said that he was going to name him to the Water Management Board. He signed a contract to complete a stormwater treatment area up in Martin County. He had already been working for the district and had done a similar project in Palm Beach County. The company that was supposed to do the Martin County project ended up having a lot of problems. The district fired them. Mr. Bergeron's had also bid on that project and was the second lowest bidder. So when they fired the first company, they turned to Bergeron's company and said, you know, can you take over this project? That had been in the works long before he was appointed to or named to the Water Management District.
So right now, where are we in this Ethics Commission look at him? I think they cleared him, though,
yes,
right?
Yes, so the staff has recommended that there not be any issues that would cause a conflict, the Ethics Commission still has to review that recommendation, and they'll take that up later this month. I checked with the Water Management District this morning to see if there was any word yet whether or not he'd be at the next board meeting, and they said they had not been told anything yet.
You know, again, as we had mentioned many times on the program, right from the start, this governor just comes out and he starts making a lot of big changes. But overall, the environmental community, the different advocacy groups, environmental groups, what are they saying about him, about the governor's, what he's done in this very short period of time that he's been in office?
I mean, the ones I talked to seem fairly hopeful. I mean, he has big backers like the Everglades Foundation, the Everglades Trust, the Everglades Trust actually endorsed him. But I think the fact that he is taking these issues on head on, asking for a lot of money for projects, talking to the president, trying to get him to put more into Everglades restoration, that is seen as pretty, I think at the time they were calling them bold moves, you know, but that is compared to the last administration. Florida environmentalists are always having to fight lawmakers for money to finish projects. To have the governor on board, you know, I think it's been a while since they've had a governor in the governor's mansion.
They certainly have. So, and again, he's only a few months in. Again, talking with WLRN's new environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Again, many of you will remember her as a reporter covering environmental stories for the Miami Herald. We're going to come back with a little bit more from Jenny here in just a moment. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for your support. Now, before the break, we were talking about environmental issues with WLRN's new environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. We spoke about the new chief science officer that Governor Ron DeSantis recently appointed. We also talked about the new members of the South Florida Water Management District Governing Board and a study from the University of Miami that looks at a possible link between these blue-green algal blooms and potential brain damage to dolphins and other sea creatures. I wanted to ask you real quickly about Lake Okeechobee, because this is another a big thing, Jenny, with the governor. And recently he's talking about wanting to lower the water levels. There's always this debate about what the water level should be. People are worried you lower it too much, you could bring on possible drought issues. But obviously we're coming into the rainy season and then hurricane season. How high the lake should be? What are they telling the governor as to what it should be?
Right. So the lake levels are actually determined by the dike. The Herbert Hoover Dike built in the 40s is undergoing a massive repair process right now. In about 2008, after Hurricane Katrina and all the problems in New Orleans, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers went back and reevaluated all their levees and dikes, and they looked at Lake Okeechobee and they said, okay, we need to set like a regulation schedule, because if the water gets too high, we're in danger of, you know, breaching the dike or causing problems. So they set the schedule that ranges between 12.5 feet and 15.5 feet. But during the rainy season, lake fills up, they start having to flush water out to the coast to keep the lake level down to protect the dike. That has caused all these problems, right? With all the blue green algae and the blooms. And so when the governor came in, he said, is there something we can do to keep the lake lower so we don't have this awful flushing? There's a range. They can actually bring it down to 10 feet, but only at the very beginning of June. And then, you know, with the rainy season, there's only so much control the Army Corps has over it. Mother Nature takes care of the rest. But that has triggered some controversy, because the water users, the ag industry, sugar growers, the utilities that border the lake, they're afraid that if you keep the lake levels too low, they're going to go into, we'll have droughts. We'll go into drought conditions. There'll be water restrictions, and they don't want that. On the other hand, you've got coastal areas dealing with the blue-green algae blooms. They're like, we can't handle the flushing. You've got to bring down the lake. So the Corps is now studying, and they've tried to bring down the lake. They've gotten it down to below 12.5 feet. Whether or not they reach that 10-foot...
10 seems low.
Yeah.
10 seems really low. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I wanted to ask you, just you personally, is, I'm used to seeing you at the Miami Herald. You know, your desk was not that far from mine, but, you know, you were in the print world, and I'm wondering, we're all wondering, it's like, why'd you want to come to radio?
Being here for a week, I am slightly terrified. There is a lot to learn, but it's been so far a really cool process, the way you guys put things together. I had no idea, now that I'm seeing the sausage being made, like how complicated it is. But at the same time, I've been a lifelong listener to Net Public Radio. I mean, I've listened for so long that I can't remember not listening. I remember Clint O'Neill when I lived down in Miami years and years ago. Oh, it shows God. You how
you
old
way,
I
you're
am.
Going, you're going back.
Right, right. But I think I just am, I'm very excited about telling stories in a new way. I love covering the environment. I love Florida. I just think there are so many opportunities to tell people about really cool places and cool things that they may not know about. I did it in print, but I think radio just kind of opens this whole new world.
I think that one of the fun things I enjoy radio, why I enjoy radio so much, is the fact that you've, and especially with your beat, would be so much fun because, you know, you're not only going to take us and tell us about these places, is that you can actually let us hear what it is that we're, you know, these, what you're going to be finding in these places. That's kind of exciting.
Yes. Yes. I find that when I listen to the radio sound stories, there's an intimacy there. You feel like you're there in a way that print doesn't allow you to do.
I also know you're a big fan of the Live from the 305.
Oh, I am. And I have many suggestions for
yes,
you.
Yes, she does. That's our new environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, coming to us from the Miami Herald. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that is Sundial for this Thursday, April 4th. And I always love to close out the show. Again, thank you so much for listening. You can go in online, find us at WLRN Sundial. Have a wonderful, wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. But don't forget, pledge your support for public radio. Become a member today, 866-247-9576. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great one. We'll talk soon.